that bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the January. It was a long night last night. June 27th show here on WEFT online on the airwaves at 90.1 on the FM dial in Champaign and streaming worldwide at weft.org. And I want to mention the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT as board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. We got a full house in here today, except David's on vacation, so we're going to kick it off with Gus with some underwriting.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO, Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
All right, thanks. I'm your host, Bob Plesney. We also have Gus Wood here, labor historian, Bill Gorrell with some of his biting commentary, and Angela's joining us again this week. And Angela, you got a special show coming up next week?
For my birthday.
For your birthday?
Yes, on the 4th of July.
Yeah. So you're going to share the topic with us this week, or are we going to surprise everybody next week?
It's going to be a
surprise. All right. Wonderful.
Born on the 4th of July.
Yeah, that's great.
Booyah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're looking forward to next week's show then, too. And why don't we kick it off with a couple of labor news stories. Gus had a couple he wanted to mention here this week.
Yeah, it was a very busy week besides the national news stories that are going on, of course, the Supreme Court decisions and whatnot. But we want to make sure that we always pay attention to the local struggles on the ground. So one of the big stories that is really brewing right now is going on in Chicago. The University of Chicago, which has already faced several weeks of sustained protests over its refusal to open an adult trauma center desperately needed by black residents on Chicago's South Side, was picketed by dozens of black construction workers demanding jobs as the university continues work on a new residence hall and dining commons. The picket, which impeded regular traffic along the busy 55th Street corridor for several hours, was organized by the African American Contractors Association, but mostly attended by workers, not contractors, despite the university's location in the majority black South Side. That's key. Their location is in the majority black South Side. Few workers on the job site are black. Thus, the workers' charge is just the latest in a long-standing pattern of racist discrimination in hiring practices by that university. And here's a quote from the president of the AACA. There's a long pattern of racial discrimination from the university. They don't want us to participate in the building of the university, even when Michelle Obama was the spokesperson for the Comer Hospital project. They'll put her out to do PR, but they didn't have any black people to actually do the job. Or as a construction worker, and one of the workers themselves, Larry Ziff, called out from the bullhorn, evoking the image of Eric Garner, who was killed by New York police when they stopped him for selling cigarettes. We've got loose cigarette jobs. We need real jobs. We need to make $4,500 a week like the workers in there. So this was a major thing that the news didn't really pick up on because of the issues going on nationwide. Right. But this is a very big story that's brewing because Chicago is becoming is transforming a lot, especially with everything that's going on with the president's library and things like that happening. Yeah. And then this University of Chicago issue. Yeah. The people are saying it. The people in Chicago, and they consider it to be a war zone of violence, they want jobs. They want jobs. They need jobs. And it's historically proven that when you allocate resources, opportunities to people, then it will build communities. Yep. So this is what the people need.
Yeah, definitely. Bill, you got any stories you're working on this week?
Well, something that's been bizarre coming up was Gibson Guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guitar is one of my favorite things. Gibson guitars are some of my favorite guitars, but unfortunately, the Gibson Guitar Company has been under some really seriously bad management in recent years. And I don't have it up right now, but one thing that happened, what's bad there is I have this CEO named Henry Jeskiewicz or something like that, Henry J. And this guy, first he threw a little hissy fit over being busted over illegal ebony, which was based on a law that was been in existence since, I think, like 1911 or something.
They used ebony on the fretboards or something?
Yeah, and that's another one, too. Since they got busted for that, they're making a big deal and popping up with some artificial crap called Rich Light for your Les Paul custom, which is like the Cadillac of guitars.
Right.
But now it's
plasticky.
Yeah, and they've done many other things over the years. And now what they're doing is they're forcing you to buy guitars that have robot tuners on them that automatically tune the guitar, among other things that people
really
generally don't want, and you don't get an option.
Yeah.
It's like you have to have it just because, I guess, Henry J. just thinks it's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Because he's apparently one of these weird psychopath, you know, new agey CEO types, you know, Silicon Valley kind of acting guy, and he just wants, he's and forcing these things on the customers. And then besides that, there was this a big kerfluffle and about somebody who wanted to take the day after Thanksgiving off, one of his management people. And he sent out this email to the whole company that was just insane. Hmm. And it's really sad, man. This is one of America's greatest companies.
Yeah.
You know, one of the few
robot tuners on there, huh?
Yeah,
I'll relate a quick little story. You know, I was at the Blues Fest last night, and a band was there from they're from California, I guess, and the guy is saying something like, you know, I forgot my tuner at home. There's a guy in the front row who's got a little guitar tuner, just tosses his up to the guy up there on stage, you know. You don't need to have robots tuning your guitars, you know. They got those cool little tuning things now that everybody can carry around in their pocket and just attach to their headstock, you know.
Right, yeah. And well, I mean, you know, besides that, I mean, you know, robot tuning guitars might be cool things. There are musicians who say, and possibly especially in blues bands, where they might want to switch to a slide and go to an open tuning.
Right.
It's just that the whole point is, why don't you just let me have
control?
Let me have a guitar that's maybe a couple of $100 cheaper because it doesn't have your fancy robot tuners on it that I don't need.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point. And to get more technical on things, they've been doing something since the 1980s, which is the Les Paul is supposed to be a really heavy guitar. That's kind of the whole point of a Les Paul guitar, is that it's heavy and so it holds notes longer.
Yeah.
And that's the way Les Paul wanted it.
Yeah.
All right. And so in the 1980s, they started doing what we call Swiss cheesing the guitars. They started drilling, and they call it now they call it traditional weight relief.
Okay.
And then in the 1990s, they started doing this chambering to the guitars, which removes even more mahogany, and they're trying to do it in a way that's supposed to be resonant and sounds better.
Yeah.
But when all the Les Paul stuff that you've heard off of all those classic records were not made on guitars like that.
Right.
In fact, I would like for them to stop that, which means that they would give up a manufacturing step, which means it should be cheaper to make the guitar. No, instead, you have to pay $5,000 for a custom-built, custom-shop guitar. But
yeah.
Anyway, this is getting real far away.
Labor.
But, no, the whole thing was, it's just their attitude, and that attitude, they're treating their employees that way.
Yeah.
And, in fact, possibly because of that, many years ago, when these people took over Gibson, and they moved the factory, a lot of the people stayed in Kalamazoo and started their own company called Heritage.
Hmm.
And even earlier than that, way back, there was a company called Guild. And they're still around. They're owned by Fender now. But Guild was founded because Epiphone started treating their employees badly. And so they split off and started the company Guild.
Hmm.
With the name Guild, which relates to the old
Workers Guild.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Interesting.
So I don't know. This is just nowhere. But it was to me, it's just one of the biggest problems in general with this country today is with management with these terrible attitudes.
Yeah, yeah. I got a quick story here that we talked about this back in April. April 14th, the National Labor Relations Board put a new election rule in. It aimed at reining in employers' powers to stall union drives. And it kind of was going to try and speed up voting on union elections. And so far, it's been having the actual effect that they wanted it to. It says, in practice, so far under the new rule, the median wait between petition and election is 24 days. Previous to that, it used to be 38 days or longer between when a union would petition for the election. And as is pretty well known, the longer that the companies can hold out before the election, the more that management can twist arms and coerce workers to not join unions and stuff like that. So a recent thing by the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals, they filed on May 20th, and by June 9th they had the ballots in the mail and stuff, which is, like I say, about 18, 19 days, something like that. So hopefully this rule seems to be having the effect that they wanted to, and may help workers be able to unionize a little quicker.
Well, hopefully, you know, that's one thing that we really want to see happen is that whenever these kind of rules come up, that you have the so-called union leadership, the AFL-CIO, you have the ASMEs, you have the other groups that actually stand up and they critically assess what these rules mean and how it can move us forward, you know,
right.
You know, because unfortunately, we don't have that happening often with a lot of rules that come about, and that they use it to see where we can politically posture ourselves instead of actually moving the workers, the people forward. And that's going to actually lead into another story that I have, because we got some major things going on.
Yeah,
a lot of people, again, this is something that a lot of people didn't know about because of the national news stories just, you know, overlapping everything.
Right.
Right now, we're about to go into U.S. auto contract negotiations. The contract negotiation between the Detroit automakers and the United Auto Workers are set to start on July 13th. And there are some critical questions that are affecting jobs, wages, and working conditions for 140,000 workers at GM, Ford, and Chrysler hanging in the balance. As the formal start of talks approaches, the UAW is keeping workers in the dark. Workers in the factories who ask shop stewards and committee men about the union strategy can't get any straight answers.
Wow.
And this is a problem.
Yep.
While maintaining the conspiracy of silence against workers, UAW President Dennis Williams held a press conference at the union's headquarters in Detroit last week for the corporate-controlled media, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. Williams made it clear that the union's rhetoric about bridging the gap, quotation marks, between Tier 1 and lower-paid Tier 2 workers was only to appease angry workers. He reassured reporters that the UAW would never do anything to impinge on the profits of the auto companies and their Wall Street investors. I will never hurt the profits of Wall Street. I will never hurt the profits of the automakers union. The workers, I'm going to appease them. I'm going to make them happy so that they do their work and make the money for the corporatists and the capitalists. We're going to make them happy.
Yeah.
And see that. And this is the kind of attitude I'm talking about that is really crippling labor. Right now in this country,
right.
When these types of things are happening, and then we have multiple national media outlets there to witness this, watching the president of a so-called powerful union demean his workers.
Yeah,
I mean that type of attitude and that type of personification. When people see that, it really demeans the labor struggle in this country, and this is happening consistently.
Yeah.
And the workers need to be calling these people out.
Right.
The United Auto Worker members should have written a statement right now denouncing every single thing that Williams said in that press conference because it's disgusting. They're not for the workers. They're not.
Yeah.
Well, and as a member of the building trades union, the laborers. I can tell you that, I mean, they're just following what the building trades unions have pretty much done. You know, actually the building trades unions are the old AF of L.
Yeah.
Okay. There was pretty much them and the railroads and the mine workers, and the railroads and mine workers were kind of like, they're kind of industrial, you know. But anyway. It's just, it's like the building trades are human resources departments for the contractors at this point.
Right.
The building trades do not sell themselves to their members, nor do they present themselves to their adversaries, the contractors, as a strong organization that will go toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose, whatever, to get our way.
Right.
And that we will not fight. Rather, their idea is, oh, well, we have experienced people, we have trained people, we pay for training, and so on and so forth, so we can supply you with these good workers, and it's a better deal for you and easier all the way around, and so on and so forth, which is sounds like what the United Auto Workers is starting to say.
All right.
But the thing is, they don't have, like, our apprenticeship. They don't have the hiring hall situation that we do.
Yep.
That makes things convenient for their employer.
Well, United Auto Workers were pretty quick to go to a two-tier wage system here a few years back.
For decades, though.
Yeah.
When it came, it has come all at once.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, too, about the apprenticeships, because I got some more quotes here from Mr. Dennis Williams. Asked about not just about the apprenticeships, but about just in general what he's trying to do with his workers. So asked about the auto company's expansion of production in Mexico, Williams rejected any effort to unite U.S. workers with brothers and sisters across the border to fight the attack on jobs and living standards. On the contrary, he said that what he wanted to do was, we got to get the number of hours down that it takes to build a vehicle. So what he's talking about doing is cutting the hours of more workers to increase productivity. And again, this is insanity. But not addressed by Williams, but lurking in the background are the proposals by GM and Ford to create a third tier or low pay workers earning between $10 and $15 an hour, who would perform supposedly unskilled work, such as sorting parts. Williams has already signaled the UAW's willingness to discuss the proposal, which would supply the union with a fresh influx of workers who would have to pay dues to the UAW for the privilege of earning poverty wages.
$10 an hour, a third tier now.
Yes.
Poverty wages, but paying union dues.
And we're talking about moving forward into the end of this decade, where the cost of living is skyrocketing and $10 to $15 is not... It's not enough to live off of anymore. So we have exploitation from the inside now in the unions, which is something that people need to dig deeper of and start criticizing people like Dennis Williams. We need to call him out on this.
Yeah, and what will happen is this is starting to get more similar to the building trades, where you have trades scabbing on each other. For example, laborers are the cheapest. So what you want to try and do is do things with laborers when you can. What's going to happen is the next thing, oh, well, we lost the fight for three tiers. Now it's going to be, well, these people, we got them in the second tier, but we really think they belong in the third tier.
Yeah.
And it's just sad. It's so sad. I mean, that was such a great union. I remember, you know, so many things they did. But, I mean, this is basically Back to the Future. And I'm talking about back to the time when that movie was made, when the huge foreign car influx just
moved into the southern states down there.
Right. And they started giving things up. I mean, they had so many different ways of things. There's a real interesting book. In some ways, it might not reflect well on blue-collar workers, but it's called Rivet Head.
Hmm.
And it was written in the 1980s, and it's by a guy named Ben Hamper. And Ben Hamper was a buddy of Michael Moore's.
Mm.
In fact, he wrote a column in Mother Jones magazine when Michael Moore, that short period of time, he was doing the editing there. And this book, Rivet Head, explains how they had things set, like where they knew how to do the work so much better than the company did that they could split a shift between two jobs. Like, one guy could cover two jobs for half a shift.
Mm.
So one guy could leave for that half and they could switch off later. But what happened was the union caved and they gave up all of their secrets.
Yeah.
They started the team concept,
you
see. And it sounds like it's happening all over again.
Why don't we take a quick musical break and we'll be back and we'll
first
open up.
First time's tragedy, the second time's farce.
There you go. Okay. We'll be back. We'll open up the phone lines for some phone calls here in just a few minutes. We'll be back with some more provocative labor news stories here at WEFT on the World Labor Hour.
People, I'm in my one room, country little shack. I'm sitting here 1,000 miles from nowhere. People, I'm right here in my one room, country little shack. All my worries and companion is an old 10-foot cotton sack. I'm gonna leave early, early in the morning. People, because I'm about to go all out of my mind. I'm gonna leave early, early in the morning. Can you tell? I'm about to go all out of my doggone mind. I'm gonna find me some kind of good man, even if he's dumb, deaf, crippled or blind.
I think we got a caller calling in here, so we'll go to the phone lines right now and open them up here on the World Labor Hour. Hello, you're on the World Labor Hour. You're on the air.
Hey, Jim Hyman calling in.
Hey, Jim Hyman, how you doing?
I want to address, well, I'm doing fine. I hope David Johnson's doing well out there with John Ryman in Oakland. I want to address Bill Gorell's question of Tonewoods here, what's happening to Gibson Guitar. Is bad management, sure. But the problem are Tonewoods. There is no more old-growth Honduran mahogany. There is no more Brazilian rosewood that's available.
Okay, I do want to say something. If that is the case, then why do you take the mahogany that you have and go through an extra step in the manufacturing process and cut holes in it? Anyway, I mean, if we want to all just get rid of guitars made out of wood, that's fine. In fact, one of my ideas lately, and I'm going to do this one of
make
these days.
Make a cement guitar.
That is the concrete tar. All right? But don't give me... I don't want to go to Guitar Center or any other store and pick up a Les Paul that is lighter than my Stratocaster that's made out of alder and is a much thinner piece of wood. That's what I'm saying, is if you're going to sell Les Pauls, make less Pauls.
Right.
You know, if we got to quit making guitars out of wood, fine. We have other products.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, there are other tone woods, but it is a crisis. The only Sitka spruce left is in Alaska. It's owned by three tribes and the loggers, with Greenpeace trying to negotiate.
Well, I hate acoustic guitars anyway. I would never buy one, so I would never have a guitar made with spruce.
All right, but for those, I'm just bringing up. There's a lack of good tone woods anymore. Okay, let's get on to something else. Back in the we were back in the 60s and even early 70s. What's going on at the University of Illinois with this? With Stephen Salida, there would be a faculty student strike. But alas, we're not back where we were able to do that. And second of all, Eunice Buckner Boone brought up this question of the slave ship that kept on even after conversion to Christianity. Kept on selling slaves. He was converted already. He was a Christian. Second of all, he created the song Amazing Grace, which was sung to the sick but alive slaves he was throwing overboard. And it became the lynching anthem of the Old South. No self-respecting AME choir will even touch that thing. It's a lynching anthem.
He was throwing the slaves overboard.
I found out recently too that the term "mother fricker" refers to came out of slavery too, referring to the Massa raping the mothers of these kids. So
interesting comments, Jim. Yeah.
Okay, bye.
All right, thanks for the call, Jim.
Oh, by the way, that number is
359-5438-5483.
I'm sorry, folks.
Fly live. So
fly live, you know, maybe take a shot, you know.
Yeah. So just to go back a little bit, the song we were listening to was from Anna Popovich, one of the performers going to be at the Blues Brews and Barbecue Fest. I think she's the headliner tonight, 10:30 till midnight. Interesting concept for the Blues Festival this year, that it has all female-led bands, all female singers, female guitar players. Anna Popovich plays a pretty mean guitar, Bill, you know, so she doesn't play not too much acoustic. She's mainly an electric guitar player. Yeah. So,
I always see her with a Stratocaster, which I find incredibly just impressive. Right there, with wow!
Yeah,
whoa!
That was quite famous album cover there,
man.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing years ago flyers with her name on it playing in town, but they never did say like she was playing blues. I never did. She was playing blues at the time.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people kind of compare her to like Stevie Ray Vaughan with her guitar style, you know. So a good dynamic electric guitar player, you know. Some other good guitar players. Joanna Connor out of Chicago is going to be there this evening. And it's a good festival over there. All right, Gus, you had another story you wanted to focus on here?
Yeah, there's been a lot of stuff going on nationally. Of course, we know one of the big Supreme Court decisions was the Affordable Care Act decision. I think that there's a big misconception of how the Affordable Act, how it has worked since it was first introduced. I was reading something from the New York Times. This guy Paul Krugman, who a lot of people know, he's basically the apologist or the President Obama's like cleanup man for the New York Times. Whenever something happens with the government, he's the one defending it no matter what it is. So, and he was saying some things about the Affordable Care Act that really got me. So I found a piece that I thought to be really interesting in terms of what it is. So everybody that knows about the Affordable Care Act, what it is it's President Obama's pro-business healthcare overhaul. And what it does is it cuts Medicare and it finds households for people who are too poor to afford health insurance. So what Krugman was saying, he was saying that he actually the title of the piece was "Hooray for Obamacare," which is very problematic in itself, consists of one cynical lie after another aimed at convincing the public that Obama's right-wing healthcare overhaul is a historic achievement for low-income Americans, which it is not.
I agree. Right.
It is somewhat of a step in the right direction, but how many times are we going to have in history these steps in the right direction only to have them totally fall completely flat on their faces?
It's a bailout for the insurance companies is what it is.
If we would have kept stepping in the right direction after, was it 1964, then there would have been no need for any kind of Affordable Care Act because we'd all be covered by Medicare.
Right. Exactly.
Because that was the original intention there, was to expand that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So what Krugman says is that this is exactly what the president said as well. This is a policy triumph, a law that despite everything its opponents have done to undermine it, it is achieving its goals, costing less than expected, and making the lives of millions of Americans better and more secure. Well, let's actually go into the actual law itself. Let's break the data down. The Affordable Care Act was signed into law by President Obama in March of 2010. And what it does is it provides partial government subsidies for low-income residents to purchase health insurance on state and federal marketplaces from private companies. So the first section of the Affordable Care Act's official write-up on the White House website is titled "Quality Affordable Healthcare for All Americans." And we all know that this language is intended to convey to the popular imagination that it's a means of creating a universal healthcare system, something that we on the left have always wanted for this country. But again, in practice, the program has left 35 million people uninsured and subject to fines,
mm-hmm.
down from the 52 million who were uninsured before its passage. So we still have a huge gap of people who cannot afford health insurance. So again, this Affordable Care Act is a contradictory statement. And we really need to understand, like, people considering this to be a huge Supreme Court historical moment in history. Well, let's look at it from, let's actually analyze what that means. What does it mean that this is a historical standpoint for the progressive part, or is this a regressive part? Because what I see happening is that people are going to start getting these ridiculous fines for not having health care that they can't afford, the fact that they don't have jobs to pay for the health care insurance, right, since jobs are being depleted at this point for the working class. I mean, what does that mean 3 to 4 years down the line? And I know, Angela, you said that recently you've had to fight this type of issue with the health care.
My thing is, we're having all these issues about healthcare itself, but the doctors aren't even real doctors these days. So, I mean, they're making way more mistakes that they made in the past. And, I mean, we're fighting against this. Okay, well, they need to get some better doctors in there. And then maybe we can go ahead and pay the money that we need to pay if they're doing their jobs.
Yeah. But just public, you know, without all that, we can actually go into the actual architecture of the program. Yeah. It's clear it was never intended to cover everyone.
No.
Let's be honest. This is a capitalist system. In a capitalism, only a few can be supported. The others are left to the wayside. That's just the way it works. So it was never meant to cover everyone. Rather, what it was intended to do was to boost the profits of insurance companies and healthcare corporations while cutting Medicare and incentivizing employers to slash their existing healthcare benefits. They relied on liberal apologists like Krugman or some of these other soft passive liberals who come about in politics, and also some of these union busting people. They rely on them to come in and to sell the program to the people as a progressive reform on part with something like the Great Society and the New Deal, which is absurd. Because we know what the Great Society program did in the 1970s, in the early 70s, and that it brought Medicare and Medicaid to the people without all this incentivizing and all this privatization that came along with the Affordable Care Act. And again, we all know what happened with Medicare and Medicaid as neoliberalism came about in the 1970s, 1980s, that there did become problems with it. But we have to make sure that we hold the Affordable Care Act accountable for what it really is. because it's incredibly dangerous to assume that this is something that is leading to what we originally thought was universal health care. That was the big thing that the president ran on in 2008, this idea of universal health care for people. And we all know that exists in a lot of industrialized countries outside the United States.
Almost everyone except us.
Exactly. You can go to Canada now. You can go to different places. And they're even running jokes about the only thing to do in Canada is to get universal health care, you know, to get free health care, stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's a goofy joke, but it's something that we really take for granted when we talk about what we look at as human rights, civil rights, and natural rights in this country. We have to really ask the questions of the public officials. Why is it the right to live? Because bodies break down. That's what we do as humans. We're sacks of meat. We're sacks of meat. We have bones. We have muscles. Our bodies break down, so we're going to get sick. We're going to need medical care, no matter how healthy you are or not.
Well, yeah, and I'm going to bring this into something wider, which is all these people in suits who, if they ever did any manual labor, it might have been when they were children or perhaps some college job or something they had when they were really young, and they spent the rest of their life wearing suits and sitting at desks and being pampered and going to gyms if they want to, and thinking that, oh well, gee, I'm 70 years old and I'm not all broke down. Well, I'm gonna tell you what, man, I'm not 70 years old. I'm 59 years old, and I've had a job the last 3 weeks where I have to climb in and out of these big ditches that we're putting storm sewer in, and walk, you know, like maybe 300 feet to go get something for something. I have to do it over and over and over, and things like that. And my hips are about gone.
Yeah.
You know, but these people, they don't understand it, and they come out like Chris Christie. You know, people like this. No, you're going to have to wait till you're longer. Alan Simpson.
Yeah.
You know, all these people, the Cat Food Commission and everything else, and they just don't understand. Sure, I might live a lot longer, but I'm not going to live that way. My quality of life is not there. It's to a point where I just cannot do these things without crippling myself. I don't want to have to get joint replacements.
I see some of those guys.
What does that add to the medical costs in this country?
I see some
forcing people to work way too long.
I see some of those guys working up there at the railroad yards and stuff. They're outside in the freezing cold and bitter winds and the heat. And them guys, they can barely walk in there in the morning sometimes, you know, and they've had knee replacements and shoulder replacements and stuff. And they're just beat up, you know.
In 2009, I had a surgery on my neck. I had a disc in my neck, and it was pushing on my spine.
Yeah.
And I had to have, you know, surgery on that, but it started in 98. Okay, so they kept telling me there was nothing wrong with me and this, that, and the other. I actually had to go to Chicago, the University of Chicago, and they told me that the reason that I couldn't get any help here is because I had a Medicaid card.
Oh, yeah, so, sure.
You know, it depends.
That's notorious on that they don't want to handle people that are on Medicaid and stuff like that. Yeah. Doctors and stuff don't want to take those patients.
That would be law.
It should be, You're required, you know.
Yeah, I went through that for 9 years.
9 years you waited to have
a
surgery done.
Me all these different pills and, okay, shoot, they about to kill me.
Yeah.
but they treated me good, and you know what? I would recommend the University of Chicago Hospital to anybody.
Great.
My mother was there.
Yeah?
Yeah, she didn't walk out.
Yeah.
Let's just to for those that have never seen Bill before, Bill looks like he's 35.
So
this is kind of this is shocking for those that know Bill and say he's 59. Yeah. Trust me, he does not look 59. So
And he's young at heart.
That's
too,
what I'm
man.
Bill's he's, like the youngest guy here.
Most immature, perhaps.
But yeah, just to bring this back into full circle, what we're trying to talk about here for our listeners is that we understand what people want. The people in America want universal free health care, as all industrialized countries have at this point, because it is virtually impossible to pay for the ridiculously high rising cost of health care. So what the Obamacare, what the Affordable Care Act is doing is taking away taking away the opportunities for people to be able to afford those things and then fining them for it while bailing out insurance companies and giving privateers a great way to make some more business in this country. Because the number one business right now, I'm telling you, is the medical business in this country.
Who's building around town, and it's the hospitals. You know, I mean, they're just putting additions on and additions on, and, you know. So.
Privatizing healthcare. Yeah. And then, of course, things going on now with prescription drug costs and those things. Like Angela was saying, they're actually, I've actually heard people who go into these, like, these places where they're just given drugs after drugs after drugs, knowing that the person, that the people cannot actually cure them or work with them. They just keep drugging them
up. Yep. But you know what? Not only that, I mean, how would you know? You don't even know if you're getting better or not, because once you take the drugs they're giving you, then you're out in another world, you know?
Exactly.
So you don't even know if it's working or not. And then these drugs that they're giving us, I feel that they're experimental, because these people that are prescribing these drugs won't even take that stuff themselves, you know?
So just to conclude, and what I've been trying to say, I'm going to state this explicitly. I honestly believe that the Affordable Care Act is a right-wing business module for health insurance mandate program designed to cut Medicare and force people to hand over money to health insurance companies through the threat of fines and shift an ever-grading burden of healthcare costs onto the consumers and encourage companies to slash employee healthcare benefits. That's exactly what's happening at this point. And like I said, we can have an Affordable Care Act, but this one that is currently on the books needs to be revised immediately, or we're going to start seeing a lot of issues. Well, we've already seen a lot of issues with the working people, but the issues are going to grow exponentially in the next few years if we don't call out this Affordable Care Act. It needs to be better. It needs to be revised. It needs to be for the people, because right now it is not for the people.
All right. Another quick musical break, and then we'll be right back here on the World Labor Hour on WEFT in Champaign.
Well, I played about everything tonight with my fingernails. Hey, now, does that sound like a typewriter to you? Well, it did to me one time about 20-some years ago. In fact, I used my fingernails to write a song called 9 to 5 while we was on the set. Now, well, Jane Fonda and Minnie Tomlin were biting their nails. I was just a-picking mine. Well, I tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. I pour myself a cup of ambition. I yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Well, I jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the street, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job. From 9 to 5, yeah! Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind. They never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5. For service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fair promotion. I want to dream just to watch them shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. You're in the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in. Tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. I just know it. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind. They never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5, they got you where they want you. There's a better life. Y'all dream about it, don't you? It's a rich man's game. I don't care what they call it. And you spend your life putting money in his wallet. 9 to 5, just working, 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 working 9 to 5. They got you working
So we're back here on the World Labor Hour, and that, of course, was Dolly Parton doing one of her classic tunes, 9 to 5, and just wanted to remind folks that there's a Dolly Parton tribute going on, and it's a benefit for WEFT 90.1 FM. That's happening tonight, Saturday, June 27th. Doors open at 6. The show starts at 7, and it's put on by the Champaign-Urbana Singer-Songwriter Collective, and it's going to feature a whole boatload of local artists, Gloria Rubel and Paul Sabuco, John Kappas and Suzanne Warner, Kevin Elliott, our own Kevin Elliott here, Cliff and Christy Stoker, Paul Kotheimer, all kinds of folks are going to be there. Admission's $10, but all proceeds do benefit Community Radio 90.1 FM. And it's happening right next door in Mike and Molly's Beer Garden. It's going to be a wonderful night out there, so we invite all the listeners to come out and enjoy this tribute of to Dolly Parton. A bunch of great local performers going to be doing a bunch of classic Dolly Parton hits, and I'm sure 9 to 5 will be in there. So a lot of things you can do downtown Champaign. Like I say, the Champaign Blues Brews and Barbecue Fest, and WEFT has their tent over there. So come out there and meet some of the WEFT airshifters and enjoy some blues, brews, and barbecue.
Hey, I don't have any details, but I've been working in Tolono lately.
Yeah.
And it's fun days in Tolono.
Oh, it's Tolono fun days?
Yes, it's wonderful. Fun days.
Yeah.
It's the only 2 days of the year that they can have fun in Tolono.
Yeah.
And that was yesterday, maybe it's today and tomorrow.
And they got a park out there, Westside Park, I think. Isn't that where they kind of have some of this stuff? And then downtown, of course, too.
Yeah, well, I know for sure they're going to have fireworks tonight.
Yeah, good stuff.
And there's other things going on, like, you know, the typical, I'm sure they probably have car show, you know, that kind of thing, that.
But. Yeah, part of the Blues Fest is a motorcycle show today, too. So if you're into motorcycles, the Dinosaurs Motorcycle Club has their judging going on this afternoon, and they'll roll out some pretty fancy motorcycles here, vintage cycles and some chromed cycles, and
it's gonna be nice. Dinosaurs. I think they're kind of mainly sort of Rantoul based, aren't they?
I think they got a club over a clubhouse over on Country Fair Drive over there, right by where what used to be called DR Diggers, but it's now apparently called Pippa's Pub. So.
It's a nice day for it, too.
Yeah,
is that on South Country? Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I know where you mean. Man, that's really... Yeah. Okay, but anyway, Saturday in Tolono, there will be a parade. I think that's coming up at noon, actually. Scoville Mobile Petting Zoo, outdoor church service, live music, girls travel softball game, drawing for golf cart raffle, fireworks. Oh, man. Both days, food court, flea market, and more. Guess no car show. That's usually, you know, that's, oh man, they always have that.
Tolono fun days.
Fun days? The only 2 days you can have fun in Tolono.
Yeah. All right. I think Gus has one more topic he wants to bring up during today's show. So.
Yeah, we have to go back into Charleston, of course.
Sure.
The big thing, you know, one of the biggest issues I've had, and I spoke about this last week, was the the media propaganda to depoliticize this racist massacre and take it away from the roots of white supremacy and put into the idea of gun control. And there's been a lot of stuff coming out now. The president of the NRA, I'm sure everybody has heard about this by now, basically accused the victims of their own deaths for not having guns in the church when the shooter arrived. So what actually we have going on here, and this is very problematic because the president bit into this garbage as well. So when it comes to actions beyond the words, the main proposal put forward among the political class has been for gun control after these horrific racist shootings. And this was a political movement. So here's a quote from the president himself. "You don't see murder on this kind of scale with this kind of frequency in any other advanced nation on earth."
Really?
"Every country has violent, hateful, or mentally unstable people." Again, what are we doing with this racist massacre? He's calling it hateful and mentally unstable and gun violence and all this other stuff. And then he finishes by saying, "What's different is not every country is awash with easily accessible guns." So, in other words, what this most in this ridiculous concept, what they're basically trying to say is that if he did not have those guns, then those nine people would still be alive today. So again, the question remains, what are we going to say about this? America's disease screamed the headline on the cover of the New York Daily News over a picture of the shooter. Exactly right. But the subheading and background pictures clarify that the disease was not racism or white terrorism, but gun violence striking the nation again. And gun violence is a phrase without political content or context. And it was never used to describe the shooting rampage of Nidal Hassan, a Muslim American who shot dozens of soldiers at Fort Hood in what was universally called a terrorist attack. Nor, for that matter, do the media ever use the phrase gun violence to refer to the daily shootings committed by police, Border Patrol, or U.S. soldiers. That's tens of thousands of people armed with the most sophisticated weaponry in history and able to use it with impunity, who form part of the fabric of society that just can't seem to fathom why there is just so much violence. So the question of the logic of gun control is not all to line up with the paranoid vigilante politics of the main organization and the ones who oppose legislation. We got to talk about the National Rifle Association. I mean, throughout history, the National Rifle Association, whenever there have been mass shootings, there's always been some ridiculous person, usually the president, that will come out and say something that will take guns out of the equation.
Right.
And now what we have going on here is...
It's not guns that kill people, they always say.
Yeah, they always say, yeah, good people it's, with guns it's can bullets. Stop bad people with guns.
Bullets kill people.
Yeah.
Or the Chris Rock thing, yeah, I meant charge $500 per bullet.
Yeah.
And the loudest proponents of gun control today are politicians in the same offices where their predecessors battled. Often literally the Black Panthers decades ago, the mayors of police departments of cities with major racial and wealth inequalities. None is more prominent than former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, founder of Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and more recently, Every Town for Gun Safety. Even as Bloomberg built a national reputation as a gun control advocate, he was quite the gun enthusiast himself, as long as the guns were in the hands of his New York City Police Department.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bloomberg infamously bragged about having the seventh largest army in the world with the New York Police Department. He would go on record saying these things, that I have the seventh largest police army in the world. And this is in the name of saving the people. But actually, it was gunning down black and brown people in the New York City streets. This is the problem with the main arguments in favor of gun control. They have nothing to say about the massive militarization of the state. From police officers to Border Patrol to private security forces, or about the obvious racist dynamic of the militarization. And there's no correlation that people want to put together with the militarization of police in America with the massive shootings and assassinations that happen overseas with the American military. There is a direct correlation between the murders ramping up in the 2000s on American soil with the murders ramping up globally, and also with neoliberalism and global capitalism spreading to other countries to stop people from challenging this new capitalist system. Because that's what happens in neoliberalization. When the people say that they do not like the system and challenge it, do you have to use repression to stop those people from doing things? And that's what's been happening in America, and that's what's been happening overseas as well. Except the difference is, here in America, we have that foundational white supremacy capitalist system that was created in the 1600s. That feeds a lot of this behavior and a lot of these antics for a lot of these white supremacists and murderers to do these things. And that's the way we have to really look at this. And that's why the gun control topic for the Charleston massacre is flawed, because nobody's actually bringing up the real context behind what gun control really means in a racist sector and also in a racist global neoliberal capitalist world. And that's something that I was just posing out there for the people listening and for my co-hosts.
Yeah, well, you know what, I can agree with that. And also, I'm going to tell you, it's not guns or bullets killing people, it's money. Money, because without that money, you wouldn't have been able to purchase that gun, you know. But money is killing a lot of people, and you know what, a lot of people, you know, they have all this money, and they want to keep that money flowing.